All right, so welcome to class. This is Bio 231, and it's March 5th, and we're going to have a lecture on muscle tissue today, mostly skeletal muscle tissue. And what can you tell me about skeletal muscle tissue? What do you know about skeletal muscle tissue? It's voluntary. Yeah, it's under voluntary control. And of the major groups of tissues in your body, where does it belong? Is it epithelium? Is it connective tissue? It is? Aha, trick question. It's muscle tissue. It belongs all by itself. Remember, you got epithelium, you got connective tissue, muscle, and nervous tissue. And muscle is just a tissue all by itself. And what is it specialized to do? Contract. It can shorten, right? That's what muscle tissue does. It can't lengthen with force. It can only shorten with force. All right, so let's take a look at some, especially skeletal muscle tissue, we're going to be concerned with today. All right, so what are the functions of muscle tissue? Well, movement is important because there's one kind of muscle tissue that's called skeletal muscle. What are the other two kinds of muscle tissues called? Cardiac is one, and smooth muscle, and remember, skeletal muscle is the only one that's voluntary. Smooth muscle and cardiac muscle is involuntary. You don't have conscious control over smooth or cardiac muscle, only skeletal muscle. So, it's skeletal muscle is connected to what part of your body? Mostly, not 100% of the time, but mostly it's connected to your skeleton, and that's how it got its name, right? And when a skeletal muscle contracts, it pulls different bones together. It brings bones together. And so it's important for movement, moving your body parts around. All right, but that's not the only important thing for skeletal muscle. Even though you're not thinking about it right now, you're using a lot of skeletal muscle to sit up straight in your chair and to take notes. All right, and this does a lot to protect your joints, to make sure that you don't bend a joint backwards, for instance, or sideways if it's not designed to undergo that kind of motion. And so we say maintenance of posture is very important. So even though you're not moving, just by staying stationary, you have to use a lot of muscles to stay in one position. The other thing is joint stabilization. Right now you're using a lot of muscles in your neck. If you were to relax all those muscles, then your head would go through some kind of weird motion, maybe to the side, maybe even hit the desk, right? And so you could damage. I actually went to school with quite a few people that were excellent at doing things like that during lecture. There was one guy that would fall asleep, and we would all just kind of stop and watch him and see how far he could lean over before he actually, like, fell out of his chair. It was pretty amazing. He would really bend over far, okay? But so joint stabilization is another important function of muscles. And as a matter of fact, muscles are almost the most important thing for maintaining the health of joints. All right. And then the last thing is generation of body heat. Because tell me, what is your body temperature compared to the room temperature? Is it the same? No, it's not the same. What is it? Higher or lower? It's higher, right? You're at 98.6 degrees, basically, all right? And we're at 70-some degrees in here. And if your body temperature were to go to room temperature or 70-some degrees, right, that probably would be very close to fatal, right? So you're way different than room temperature. So muscles in your body help maintain your body temperature to where it should be. All right, so these are all important functions of muscle. The second thing that we're going to look at right over here are the functional characteristics of muscle. We want to understand what are some of the special properties of muscle. And we just said that one special property is contraction. Muscles contract, whether they're cardiac or smooth or skeletal muscle. So contractility is one thing. And the other thing is that a muscle won't contract unless it's told to contract, either by your autonomic nervous system or by your voluntary nervous system. So we say it is excitable. Skeletal muscle can be excited into contracting. Otherwise, it's going to stay in a relaxed state. The other thing is extensibility, another special property of skeletal muscle. And not only can it contract, but when it's told to relax, it can actually stretch. So skeletal muscle can get longer if it's actually pulled apart from one end to the other. That's what we call extensibility. And then after we extend the muscle, here's the last property, after we extend the muscle, we stretch a muscle and let go, what's going to happen to that muscle? It's going to snap back to its original resting length. Okay, it's going to get shorter, not because it's contracting, but because of elastic properties of skeletal muscle. All right, that's pretty cool, those elastic properties. So there are elastic fibers in muscle, and the other arrangements of different kinds of proteins in muscle make it elastic. So contractility, namely shortening, all right, but it can also stretch, that's what we call extensibility, and it won't contract unless it is excited, that's the third. And then the fourth one is elasticity, meaning that after you extend the muscle and let the tension release, then the muscle goes back to its resting length. And then here are the three kinds of muscle. You probably should be aware of what these look like when we went over them. Skeletal muscle, long tubes, right, that are striated in appearance. And those long tubes sometimes look like a fiber, so we call a skeletal muscle cell a muscle fiber. We use those terms interchangeably. Cardiac muscle, that's involuntary. It has striations, but it's not long. It's not a long fiber. It's branched and relatively short. And then since these muscle cells in your heart are relatively short, there's got to be something that glues the cells together so that they don't rip apart, so you don't have a hole in your heart when the heart contracts. What do we call those things? Between the muscle cells. They're called intercalated discs, right? And in smooth muscle, again, we don't call these fibers, but they're relatively short. They kind of look like an elongated football, and they're not striated. So that means the internal machinery of smooth muscle is different compared to skeletal and cardiac muscle. All right, so a cell in skeletal system, skeletal muscles are what we call a fiber. All right, so let's take a look at some skeletal muscle. All right, and here is a pretty good picture. Right here, let me look at the next one. Ah, this is even a better one. So here we have a bone, okay, for fun. What kind of bone is that? Yeah, that's the name of it. It's a nice long bone, right, but that's the femur. Here's the head and the neck, right, the greater and lesser trochanter. That's just a review of some bones for you that still have to take a practicum. Well, here is a muscle. All right, so for instance, this is a muscle that's in your thigh, and surrounding the whole muscle is some connective tissue. It's a sheath that surrounds this muscle, and epi means what? Means around or on top of, right? So this is the membrane that's on top of the whole muscle, and for instance, this could be maybe one of the hamstrings in the back of your thigh, and this is what we call the epimysium. So anytime you see mesium right here, you should think of muscle in particular, right? And epimysium is the connective tissue that's on the top of this whole muscle. And it's continuous, right? It runs right into this tendon. And a tendon is what kind of tissue once again? Or what kind of connection is it? I guess I want to review. What kind of connection is it? A tendon connects what two parts of your body? A muscle to a bone. And then the kind of tissue it is nice, dense, regular connective tissue. It's the strongest kind of tissue that doesn't stretch at all. It's very, very strong. So the epimysium is continuous with the tendon. So when the muscle contracts, the epimysium pulls on the tendon and the tendon pulls on the bone right here. Okay. Well, there's some other structures that we see inside muscle besides this outer covering, which we call the epimysium. If we just make a nice cross-section of a muscle, we can see that there are different compartments right here that we call bundles, muscle bundles. Sometimes we call them fascicles. All right, so here is a fascicle, and this is pulled out of the rest of the muscle. So all of these are different fascicles, and they look different because there's a connective tissue sheath around each of these fascicles. Right, and that's what we call the perimysium. Peri means surrounding on the outside of these fascicles. So a whole muscle, maybe like the biceps or triceps, okay, has the epimysium and is made up of muscle bundles or fascicles that have the perimysium surrounding them. All right, but if we look inside of a muscle fascicle, we can see what? More structures, more fine structure. These are little tiny little bundles of things. And right? Each one of these little things right here is a muscle cell. Okay, so not the group of structures that we see, but each one of these right here is a muscle cell or a muscle fiber. And again, there's connective tissue around every single muscle cell or muscle fiber. And we call that the endomysium. So the three layers are the epimysium on the outside, the perimysium around the fascicles, and the endomysium around each one of the muscle cells or muscle fibers that make up a muscle. All right, but we're still not done, because inside of a muscle cell, we see more tubular-like structures. And these things are what we call myofibrils. Oh, it's not labeled on this slide, but these are myofibrils. All right, now what else do we recognize on this slide? So if we look at the fascicle right here, and we look at each of the muscle fibers, does it have just a homogeneous color, or do you see something inside each of these muscle fibers? Like here and here and here. What do we see? And even if we look at this muscle fiber that's being pulled out of a fascicle, what do we see when you look at this? I don't quite hear anybody. Do you see anything blue? Yes. Kind of blue. Is that blue? Low intensity blue. Okay. These are nuclei. And what can you tell me about every single cell? Every cell is multinuclear. It's multinucleate because it's a skeletal muscle cell. Okay, what else do you see? If we don't look at the blue nuclei, is this color all the same? I see some striations, right? So I see some dark areas and light areas. I see another dark area followed by another light area, followed by another dark area. Can you see that on the screen? Oh yeah, even though it's kind of washed out. Okay, so I see striations. So that's a good sign that this is skeletal muscle. What's another kind of muscle that has striations? It's a kind of a muscle that only has one nucleus per cell. It's not called a fiber, and it's highly branched. And that's cardiac muscle. So cardiac muscle has striations as well. That's because of the internal machinery that we see inside of the muscle cell, which is due to these myofibrils. So these things are like organelles. Myofibrils are organelles, just like a nucleus right here is an organelle. The myofibrils are the organelles inside of a muscle fiber or a muscle cell responsible for contraction. Okay, so here's a nice micrograph, ooh, really clear one, nice magnification, using like high power. I see the striations, I see the different nuclei. Here is a muscle cell, they're long and linear. Okay, the dark band is what we call an A band, and then these light bands right here are what we call I bands. So that's pretty easy to remember, because what word has an A in it? Dark. And what word has an I in it? Light. So that's really easy to remember, right? The I bands and A bands. That's not really how it was named, but that's a good place to start to recognize some of this stuff. Okay. So these are the internal structures for contraction, right? And these things are what we're going to call sarcomeres, and we're going to get to that in just a minute. But we're going to still stay with some gross anatomy first, which is large anatomy. All right, so here's your upper appendage, and as a review, what is this bone right here? What does that look like to you? Those of you that still have to take a practicum, this is the ulna, and here is the radius, right? And you can see the styloid processes. There's a nice olecranon process. So here is what bone is this? The humerus. So here is a muscle that goes from the humerus all the way down past your elbow, and it attaches to the ulna. All right, the other attachment is up here on the humerus. And what's the job of this muscle right here? To contract, it shortens, and when it shortens, it's going to pull this part of the ulna up to this part of the humerus. And what do we call it when you decrease an angle between two bones through a joint? That's flexion. All right, so here is the prime mover for flexion. This is the most important muscle for flexion, and it's called the brachialis. All right, when the brachialis contracts, okay, which end is producing the most motion? Is it the superior end, or the proximal end, or the distal end over here? What moves? Does your arm move, or does your forearm move? when the brachialis contracts. It's the forearm that's moving, okay? And that's how we're going to define the two ends of a muscle. So every muscle basically has two ends. One end hardly moves at all, and the other end moves a lot. So the end that hardly moves is called the origin. And the other end of the muscle that is moving, the forearm, is called the insertion. That's the more movable end of a muscle. So the least movable end is the origin. The most movable end is the insertion. And pretty much every muscle in your body has to obey this kind of arrangement because it can't produce a motion unless the end, other end of the muscle is relatively fixed in position. Right? It has to have something to pull on. All right. For instance, I tried to use an example of, well, I grew up in Chicago that had a lot of snowstorms. So my car would get stuck in the snow every once in a while. So that meant that you had to get out and push your car out of the snow. But maybe around here, did you ever get your car stuck in a puddle, like mud or something like that? Probably not. Or sand, okay, maybe in sand out in the desert. So if you get out and push your car, all right, so I'll just pretend I'm pushing the bumper of my car right now. All right, so my hands are on the car, my feet are on the ground. What can you tell me about my feet if I'm going to push on my car to get it out of the stuck sand or mud or snow? Okay, yeah, you can maybe bend them a little bit, but for instance, my hand wants to push the car, right? So my hands are going to move, but what about my feet? In order to move my car, what do my feet have to be? They have to be planted in the ground, because if I push on the car and my feet slip out from under me, does the car move at all? The car is not going to move, right? So even in that example, you could consider my hands the insertion and my feet the origin. There has to always be one end of a muscle that's stationary so that it doesn't move, so that it produces the proper motion in a bone on the opposite end of the muscle. All right, so here is the origin, here is the insertion. Sometimes a muscle is going to attach to a bone with a very, very short piece of connective tissue. We call that a direct attachment. And some muscles have a very long, dense, regular connective tissue before it inserts into a bone, and that's what we call a tendon, right? It's an indirect attachment via this long tendon right here. So we're going to see a bunch of different muscles with each of those different kinds of attributes. All right, so that's gross anatomy. Let's get back to looking at some microscopic anatomy. All right, so don't forget, skeletal muscle is really long and unbranched. It looks like a fiber, hence we call it a fiber. It's multinucleate, it's striated. The plasma membrane is what we call the sarcolemma. I wanted to punch this button right here. All right, so here is a muscle cell, and here is the sarcolemma. That's the cell membrane of a skeletal muscle cell. I can see a number of different organelles, like the nucleus, right? And don't forget, skeletal muscle is multinucleate. And then here are some other organelles inside the cell. I see this looks a little bit different than these other cylinders that are inside the cell. Take a guess at what these things are. And they produce something that muscles need a lot of. Yes, right. These are mitochondria that produce ATP that allow these things to shorten. And this is what we call a myofibril. So on your slides, write down, myofibril is the organelle for contraction or shortening. All right, that's what's responsible. And when these things shorten, it pulls on the perimysium, right, via the, and then the perimysium pulls on the epimysium, and that pulls on a tendon, and that's what pulls bones together. The other thing that I notice on this slide right here are the different striations. Again, a light band and a dark band. What follows a dark band? An I band. What follows an I band? Right? An A band. All right, so they just repeat over and over and over and over again. Okay. All right, so these are the myofibrils. And if we look at a myofibril, let's zoom in even a little bit further. Okay, so here is a zoomed in region of a myofibril, and if we look in the ends of a myofibril, I see some other structure, some fine structures. These dots, And can you tell me, what do these dots look all the same, or do they look different? They look different. Some are red and some are blue. How did I do? Pretty good? They look red and blue to you? Okay. Certainly one is thick and the other is thin. All right, so let's see what that looks like in terms of just a nice lateral view of a myofibril. Okay, so I see a zigzag line here that's blue, and then I see another zigzag line over here. Right, this is the structural and functional unit of contraction of a myofibril, and it's called a sarcomere. Again, if you hear a term sarco, you should just think of muscle, a muscle cell. Like the sarcolemma is the plasma membrane on the outside of a muscle cell. So since it makes a zigzag line right here and right here, but also because it's the endpoint of a sarcomere, this is the endpoint of a sarcomere here and here, it's called the Z disc, right? Because Z is what letter of the alphabet? It's the last one, right? So the Z disc is like the end of the sarcomere right here. And then here is an I band on either side of the Z disc. So one sarcomere gets half of an I band, and then the one next to it gets a half of an I band. And then over here, right, this is the A band because it has some proteins in it that are really thick. Right, and it overlaps with some other proteins that are really thin, like these blue ones. Right, so this right here, the A band, is due mostly to these really thick filaments that are inside of a sarcomere, and the I bands are due because the thin filaments right here don't block a lot of light when you shine through a sarcomere. All right, so here is the sarcomere. The thin filaments that we see are called actin, and the thick filaments are what we call myosin. And what can you tell me about the arrangement of actin and myosin? They overlap each other, right, and they surround each other. So we never see a myosin next to a myosin. A myosin protein is always going to be next to a actin protein. And an actin is always going to be next to a myosin protein. Even if we look on the edge over here, what surrounds this myosin protein? Only the blue dots, right? Only the actin, right? And what about the actin? It's surrounded by, surrounded by myosin filaments. So they surround each other in this kind of arrangement over here. So there's going to be a special kind of motion between actin and myosin proteins, okay, to get this myofibril to shorten. All right, so from here to here is the sarcomere, and it's going to shorten. As a matter of fact, all of the sarcomeres within a myofibril will shorten at the same time. So this one is going to shorten, as well as the one to the left, as well as the one to the right, all the way from one end of the muscle to the other, and then that's going to produce contraction of the whole muscle cell as a result. If we look at a micrograph, right in the middle of the A band, sometimes it's going to have a little lighter color, and we're going to call that the H zone, because the H zone is a little bit lighter color because there's no overlap between the myosin molecule and the actin molecule. That's why it's going to look a little bit lighter in color. And here's a special structural feature within the sarcomere that we call the M line. And M line just comes about because of meaning that it's right in the middle, right? Just like metaphase is right in the middle of mitosis. Right, so here is the M line, which is in the middle. That's what anchors these myosin proteins, right smack in the middle of the sarcomere. Now, what about these actin molecules? Where do they get anchored within the sarcomere? Okay, the myosin is anchored in the middle, but what about the actin? It's on the Z discs, so they're attached to the Z discs. Right, so myosin attached to the M line, actin is attached to the Z disc over here. All right, the other thing that I use interchangeably is by talking about actin and myosin in terms of their thickness. Which one is the thin filament? It is the actin, and which one is the thick one? The myosin, right. All right, so muscle is going to shorten. So here we see a couple of proteins. We got actin and myosin. Which one would you guess shortens when a muscle is shortened? Is it the actin or myosin molecule? I want you to think about that for just a second. Okay, those would be the two possibilities for when this sarcomere shortens. All right, let's take a look at the next picture. Okay. All right, so here's a little bit different drawing of a sarcomere. And remember, the sarcomere goes from Z-disc to Z-disc right here. Here's the M-line right smack in the middle. And attached to the M-line is the thick filament or myosin. Attached to the Z-disc is the actin or thin filament. And there's one other kind of protein that we see, and that's called a titin protein. And that titin protein, what does it look like if you're going to describe this thing? Not just by color, but describe it by shape. It looks like a? Yeah, it looks like a spring. And what can you do with a spring? You can pull it, okay, and it will stretch very nicely, and when you let go of a string, what will happen to it? It will come back to its original location, right? So the titin molecule is responsible for the elasticity of skeletal muscle. So skeletal muscle can stretch, but then it goes back to its resting length after that tension is released. But this is not the muscle that produces tension when a muscle contracts. It's responsible for what? Stretching, and then going back to its original shape after the tension is released. Okay, other things I see on this myosin molecule are some of these branches, some of these processes sticking out from the myosin. These are what we call myosin head groups. And in this particular picture, they're not connected to an actin molecule, but there can be a time when they actually reach up and grab an actin molecule and attach to it. And that's what we call a cross bridge. So a cross bridge can form when a myosin head group attaches to an actin molecule. That's going to be an important stage of contraction. All right, let's take a look at contraction a little bit more. Let me see where we are right here. Okay, actually I want to describe this slide a little bit. So here is that nice muscle fiber or skeletal muscle cell. We see myofibrils. Each one of these little tubes is a myofibril. That's the organelle for contraction. And myofibrils are made out of these repeating units over and over and over again. What do we call this thing from a Z-line to a Z-line? That's a sarcomere. That's the structural and functional unit of contraction. So if we know how a sarcomere works, we know how the whole muscle contracts. Right? What's the structural and functional unit of life called? That's a cell. That's right. So if you know how a cell works, you know something about life. What about the structural and functional unit of compact bone? What was that called? Compact bone, solid bone. That was called an osteon. Remember all the little lamellae and the central canal and the osteocytes and lacunae and the canaliculi that makes an osteon? All right, but for a muscle, it's going to be a sarcomere. So here's a nice cross-section zoomed in to just this section right here. And we see the myofibrils and a lot of mitochondria. And then here is some smooth endoplasmic reticulum. It doesn't have any ribosomes. So can this smooth endoplasmic reticulum make a protein? Is that the job of this ER? No, it's got to be rough ER to make a protein. The job of this endoplasmic reticulum is that it stores calcium ions. Right, calcium ions. Where else do you find calcium? In bones, right? So calcium is necessary to make your bones nice and strong so they don't fracture. Nobody wants that. But here is another location. It's in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? And it's connected to these transverse tubules that are connected to the cell membrane. This is a special little tube that takes electrical activity from the cell membrane, and it delivers this electrical activity to the whole interior of the skeletal muscle cell. And when that electrical activity moves down this transverse tubule, it excites the sarcoplasmic reticulum into releasing calcium to the interior of these myofibrils. All right, so when this muscle is told to contract, there's an electrical signal that comes down the cell membrane into the T-tubules or transverse tubules, and it tells the sarcoplasmic reticulum to release calcium. And that calcium is then going to cause the Z-discs to come together. And when they come together, what happens to the length of a muscle? It shortens. Okay. So that's another really important function of calcium. You need it for strong bones, but you also need it for what happening in muscle? You also need it for muscle to contract. All right, so I don't know, what's more important for you? Muscle contraction or to have strong bones? Because there's a muscle that allows you to breathe. That's your diaphragm. Your diaphragm needs proper levels of calcium so that you can inhale. All right, so if you were to make a choice in your body to having strong bones or muscle contraction, what would your choice be? Have calcium in sarcoplasmic reticulum or calcium in bones? At this point in time, you're probably saying, well, I don't want to make that choice. But if you're not exercising, if you don't have calcium in your diet or vitamin D, your body's going to be deficient in calcium. Your body has to make a choice. So what's more important? Breathing or having strong bones? Breathing is more important. And that's exactly the choice your body makes too. As we get older, all right, for proper muscle contraction, where does your body go to get calcium if you don't have it in your diet? It goes to bones, and that's one of the reasons why we all suffer from osteoporosis. Okay, so your body makes that same choice. All right, and where does that calcium come from to make muscles contract? It's from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? It kind of looks like a blue network that's surrounding all of these myofibrils right here. All right, and the electrical signal passes into the sarcoplasmic reticulum from these T-tubules. And this right here, sometimes we call this a triad. It's made up of a T-tubule and a couple of the terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So there's a special connection between the T-tubule and the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And without calcium, right, these myofibrils will not be able to contract. Right, that would be terrible. But in order for contraction to take place, there has to be ATP available as well, and that comes from mitochondria that you see spaced everywhere. All right, so this is a pretty good exam figure. It's a really nice exam figure. All right, so make sure you can label mitochondria. And these things are the organelles for contraction. These are myofibrils. Surrounding every myofibril is the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Here's a nice triad, which is made up of the terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum and the T-tubule. And remember that the T-tubule is responsible for taking electrical excitation from the cell membrane deep inside the cell. Right, so that's another functional property of skeletal muscles, that it's excitable because that electrical signal can be shared everywhere inside the cell via this T-tubule right here. All right, let me take a look at the next picture. Okay, so here we have a nice sarcomere. Here is that actin filament. Here is that myosin filament. You can see a myosin head group coming off the thick filament. When calcium is released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, this myosin head group can reach up and attach to an actin filament. But calcium is necessary for that to happen. Where does that calcium come from? Yeah, that sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? The sarcoplasmic reticulum. And then if there's ATP available, right, then this crossbridge can articulate, kind of like your finger, it can flex while it's attached to this actin filament, and it's going to then pull the actin molecule over the myosin filament. All right, so I had a question for you. We have a myosin filament, at least in the model that I'm going to show you here, in this green marker, and here's a blue filament. Okay, now can these markers shorten if I push on them from end to end? Let's consider these to be proteins inside of a sarcomere. So can I shorten the length of these markers right here? I can't, right? And if I put them end to end, all right, we can see, we'll just say that the endpoints are the Z discs, so that's the length of a sarcomere, all right? And neither actin or myosin can actually shorten inside the sarcomere, so how are we going to get these Z discs closer together if we can't shorten the actin and myosin proteins. Okay, notice that in the sarcomere, they're not really joined end to end. They are what? They overlap each other. All right, so how do we make the ends of these markers get closer together? By sliding the markers over each other. All right, so the myosin and actin will actually slide over each other, and then, all right, the whole muscle cell is going to get shorter when that happens. But what about the actual length of actin or myosin? Does it get shorter? No, they just do what? They just slide over each other. That's what we call the sliding filament model for muscle contraction. All right, so let me show you a video of that. I can make this video a little bit bigger. All right, so here we can see a sarcomere from Z-line to Z-line. And this right here where I have the arrow is the, what molecule is this? Myosin, or the thick filament, right, that has these cross bridges on it. Here's an actin molecule. You can tell because it's attached to the Z-line. All right, so the calcium signal has come in, and we can see these head groups have attached to the actin molecule. All right, so now let's put the video in motion. It's narrated, so you can listen to this in Blackboard. Okay, here's that H zone. Here's the dark band. All right, so you can see that the head group reaches up, grabs hold of myosin, and then it flexes and it pulls the actin molecule toward the center of the sarcomere. That happens on either end of the sarcomere. So what happens to these Z-lines? They get closer together, right? Okay, oh, let me pause. And when they get closer together, okay, notice that the A-band stays the same length, but what happens to the I-band? It disappears or gets really short, right? Because now the whole sarcomere is filled up with overlapping actin and myosin molecules. All right, maybe we can kind of watch that again. If I bring this back, oh, I can control it like this. All right, so here is a sarcomere when it's relaxed. There's a nice H zone right here. There's a big wide I band. And when myosin attaches to actin and pulls on it, it's going to pull the Z line toward the M line. It's going to pull this Z line toward the M line over here. And the distance between the Z lines is going to get smaller. Okay. See the head groups pulling on the actin? And guess what's happening to that H zone? It's disappearing. What about that I band? It's shortening as well, or disappearing, right, as the muscle contracts. All right, so neither the actin shortens or the myosin shorten. They just slide over each other. As long as calcium is available and ATP is available, so the sarcomere shortens. That's the way we say the sarcomere is the structural and functional unit of contraction in skeletal muscle. All right, so here's just a zoomed-in region of that video we were watching. Let's take a look at some other pictures that we have. So what does your book have? It just has... Okay, a sarcomere from Z-line to Z-line. When it's relaxed, I see a little bit of overlap between actin and myosin. Okay, but kind of memorize this picture. Kind of look at the length of myosin and the length of actin right here. And then let's go to the next picture. Okay, notice that the myosin protein looks the same length compared to the previous picture. And the actin looks the same length compared to the previous picture. The only thing that changes is that the Z discs have been pulled together so that that whole sarcomere shortens. All right, so what disappeared? Let's go back and look at some of the, here is the H zone right here. Here is an I band. What does this look like when a muscle contracts? Okay, the H zone disappears because there's complete overlap now between actin and myosin, and the I bands have almost disappeared because the Z lines have been pulled together as a result. Okay, so you might want to go back and look at that video once again. All right, so how do we excite muscle tissue into contracting, especially skeletal muscle tissue? Well, here is a nerve, a neuron, that sends an electrical signal to its end point right here that we call an axon terminus. So here's the terminus of a neuron. And let's look into this. So there's electrical activity that comes down to the nerve ending. Let's zoom into this region right here. This is what we call a synapse. And in skeletal muscle, we call it the neuromuscular junction. Right? So it's a junction between a neuron and a muscle. And there's a signal in a neuron, and we're going to look at and see how that signal then corresponds, right, to a muscle contraction. We call that excitation-contraction coupling. So electrical signal comes down to this little swelling at the end of a neuron, and there are vesicles that contain a chemical substance that we call a neurotransmitter. And it's called a neurotransmitter because it's coming from a neuron, and it's going to be used to transmit a signal into the skeletal muscle. The electrical signal bumps in to the axon terminus, and it causes these vesicles to move over to the end of the cell, right here, and these vesicles fuse to the cell membrane. So the interior contents of these vesicles then gets released into the junction between these two cells, right? And these chemicals are what we call that neurotransmitter once again. They diffuse across this cleft between the two cells, right, and they bump into the cell membrane. When they bump into the cell membrane right here, a lot of times they're going to bind to a receptor, and that receptor then causes another electrical signal to flow over the cell membrane of a muscle cell. And that electrical signal then goes into the T-tubule, and it causes release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so the way this signal moves is that in a neuron, it's an electrical signal. That electrical signal then gets converted into a chemical signal in the synapse. And when that chemical bumps into the cell membrane of the muscle signal, or is the muscle cell, it gets converted back into an electrical signal that then flows over the whole skeletal muscle cell. So the short idea that I want you to know is that this synapse right here is a way of communication between the nerve cell and the muscle cell. The signal within the nerve moves as an electrical signal. The signal between the cells moves as a result of a chemical signal, which is the neurotransmitter, right? And then that signal then gets reconverted into an electrical signal in the muscle cell. So in terms of the neuron, it's an electrical signal. Across the synapse, it's a chemical signal. And then within the muscle cell, it's an electrical signal. So the way the signal goes is electrical, chemical, electrical. This is a special kind of synapse that we call a chemical synapse. Because how does the signal move from the neuron into the muscle? As a chemical, not as an electrical signal, but as a chemical signal. That chemical signal is what we call a neurotransmitter that gets released from this neuron right here. All right, and so we see release of calcium that flows into the myofibrils, and that causes myosin to attach to actin. They start to slide over each other. And then the Z discs are going to move closer together, causing contraction of the muscle. Okay. So I know some of you are wondering, well, how do you know, or how do these vesicles right here know when to move over and attach to the cell membrane of this nerve cell right here, so that the neurotransmitter can be released? Well, when this electrical signal comes down to the axon terminus, that causes calcium to enter the cell because there's high calcium on the outside, low calcium on the inside of the cell. There are channels that open up, and when calcium is released into this axon terminus, the vesicles move over and release neurotransmitter. Right? And then that neurotransmitter causes excitation of the skeletal muscle cell. Without calcium in the extracellular fluid, then the neuron couldn't send the signal to the muscle to contract, right? Which is another important reason to have proper levels of calcium in your body. Because It controls how synapses work, how cells communicate with each other, right? So all junctions between nerve cells in your brain rely on calcium as well as muscle contraction. So now we have three choices where to have proper calcium levels. You need to have proper calciums in your bone to make bones strong. You need to have proper calcium inside muscles so they contract. And you need to have proper calcium so that nerves can communicate with each other. All right, so, and that's all nerves everywhere in your body. So where would be like the last place you would want to have proper levels of calcium if you were like low on calcium? Okay, would it be bones to make bones strong, in muscles so that muscles can contract, or in nerves so that they can send signals to each other? Where would be like the least important place for you to have proper calcium? In bones, because without proper calcium, your nervous system wouldn't operate. Without calcium, your muscles wouldn't contract, right? And those are far more important than to have proper calcium in bones, right? And so your body makes that same choice too. So as we get older, we lose calcium from our bones when that happens. Okay. So sometimes we call this the synaptic knob, this little swelling at the end of a neuron. We have these synaptic vesicles that contain a chemical which is the neurotransmitter. And one particular name of a neurotransmitter is acetylcholine. Sometimes it's abbreviated capital A, capital C, little H. Acetylcholine is one specific name of a neurotransmitter. And we have a lot of different neurotransmitters in our body, all used for the same purposes, which is synaptic transmission, to carry information across the synapse. Acetylcholine is one of them. All neuromuscular junctions use acetylcholine as the neurotransmitter. All right, so I want you to know what a neurotransmitter is. It carries signals across the synapse and a chemical synapse. And probably you should know the name of at least one neurotransmitter, namely acetylcholine. Anybody know the name of any other kind of neurotransmitters you've ever run into in your life? Like epinephrine, norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine. There's all kinds of different neurotransmitters used in different parts of your nervous system. And in physiology, we have a lot of fun learning about the different functions of these different kinds of neurotransmitters. Okay, then, so a neurotransmitter starts an electrical signal on the muscle cell. How does that electrical signal get down into the interior of the cell? It can't just flow. There's got to be a special pathway. What's a special structure that allows that electrical signal to go from the cell membrane deep inside of a muscle cell? There's a special structure. I see it on this slide. It is the T-tubule right here, right? So these arrows, they kind of look blue arrows, like blue arrows to me, that signifies the electrical signals getting down to the interior of the cell. And then when that electrical signal gets into a T-tubule, it causes release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and that causes the cross bridges to form between actin and myosin, and they start to slide over each other. And when actin and myosin slide over each other, what happens to these Z-discs? They come together, and that shortens the sarcomere, which then causes the whole muscle to contract. All right, well, we used to talk about troponin and tropomyosin, but we don't anymore in this class, so we don't have to be too concerned with that. But we are interested in a motor unit. So let's look at a motor unit right here. Here we see a cross-section of the spinal cord inside your vertebral column, and I see some nerves that leave the vertebral column, leave the spinal cord, going out through that vertebral foramen between different vertebrae. And here's a nerve that's taking electrical signals to this muscle. We could call this the biceps muscle, for instance. But notice, does this one nerve just go to one muscle cell? How many muscle cells does this blue nerve go to? I see two. I see one here and one here. Here are all the axon terminuses of this one axon. And then here is a different neuron. How many muscle cells does this go to? And I can see, yeah, 1, 2, 3. Okay, so the way that a muscle cell contracts, so here's a muscle cell with a bunch of myofibrils, is that it contracts with an all or none response. Once it's excited into contraction, this one muscle cell will contract with all of its ability. It either is contracted or it's not contracted. All right, and the same thing for each of these muscle fibers right here. All right, but you're saying, well, if a muscle contracts with an all or none response, how is it that I can very nicely pick up a very light marker contracting my biceps brachii, or pick up a really heavy bowling ball with that same muscle? How come I can have a graded response depending on the object that I'm picking up? Right, a very easy contraction when I'm picking something up that's light, or a really strong contraction when I'm picking something up that's really heavy. If a muscle fiber always contracts with 100% of its ability, how come I can cause gradations in tension within my biceps brachii? And that is because not all of the muscle fibers within your biceps brachii contract at the same time. Because some muscle are bunched together, like here there are two, and in this particular neuron there are three. So if I just excite this blue neuron right here, what's the contraction going to be like compared to when this red neuron gets excited? Is it going to be greater or less or the same? It's going to be less, right? Because this blue neuron only goes to two fibers, while this red one right here goes to three. So the one that goes to three is going to produce a little bit stronger contraction by 30%. All right, and what happens if you need to have even a stronger contraction compared to with these three muscle fibers contract? What can you do? You can then join, right, motor unit 1 and 2 together, and then you'll get 5 muscle fibers contracting. And if you need the maximal contraction out of your biceps, what's going to happen? Not just motor unit 1 and 2, but motor units 3, 4, 5, all the motor units that go to the biceps will be excited, so that all of these muscle fibers will contract in unison, producing what, the strongest possible contraction. All right, so a motor unit is defined as one neuron plus all the individual muscle fibers that are controlled by that one motor neuron. All right, so that's a motor unit. And the process of getting stronger and stronger muscle contractions from a muscle is what we call recruitment. So if you need a very weak contraction, one motor unit will be causing contraction. If you need a stronger contraction, then it will recruit other motor units to make that muscle contract with more and more tension. Okay. So that's the importance of motor units. And this ratio of neurons to the number of fibers it contracts depends on what part of the body it is. If a certain part of your body needs a lot of fine control, like for instance in your hands, right, then there's going to be a few muscle fibers for every motor neuron so that you have fine control. But other parts of your body kind of all contract in unison, like your back muscles. You don't do any fine manipulation or writing or hand signals with your back muscles. So in your back, you have many, many, maybe thousands of muscle fibers all connected to the same motor neuron, so that pretty much all the muscles in your back contract at the same time. So postural muscles have a very big ratio, but fine muscles for fine control in your body have a very small ratio of neurons to muscle fibers. Okay. All right, let's just say a couple things about cardiac muscle and smooth muscle. Okay, what does cardiac muscle look like? It's right in here. Okay, so skeletal muscle, long linear fibers. Right, they are striated. Cardiac muscle, you can see, still has striations. So it has actin filaments and myosin filaments still arranged as a sarcomere. So there's sarcomeres that line up from one end of the cell to the other. Here are the endpoints of a skeletal muscle cell. This is what we call an intercalated disc. So it glues these two neighboring cells together with desmosomes. But it also has a special electrical connection through this intercalated disc, so that when one cardiac muscle cell gets stimulated electrically, that electrical signal can get to the neighboring cell, right? Which then can go to a neighboring cell. It can spread all the way up and down from right to left, and because cardiac muscle cells are branched, where else can that electrical signal go? Not just right and left, but also from, on this slide, from top to bottom. It can kind of just zigzag its way all the way throughout the whole thickness of the heart. So when the heart is told to contract, not only does it contract from right to left, but also through from top to bottom as well. So your heart contracts as a unit. And that's very important because your heart is pumping blood. In order to pump blood, the whole heart has to contract to squish blood out. So this is what we call a gap junction that allows electrical signals to pass from one cell to another so that the heart contracts as a unit. Would it be a good idea to have gap junctions between skeletal muscle cells? Would you want your skeletal system to contract as a unit? No, you don't want gap junctions between skeletal muscle cells because if only one little muscle in your little finger was excited into contracting, say I want to just wiggle my little finger. Hopefully that wasn't obscene, okay? I didn't mean to be, right? But if I contract that little muscle right there, if there are gap junctions between all the skeletal muscle cells in my body, what would have happened? Your whole body would contract, all right? That would be terribly inefficient, right? You couldn't write, you couldn't lift up a Coke or anything to drink, right? So gap junctions, not available in skeletal, but in cardiac muscle cells, they are because you want your whole heart to contract as a unit. Smooth muscle. Sometimes there are gap junctions between them, sometimes not, depending on the kind of smooth muscle it is. But notice that smooth muscle is missing something that we see in cardiac and skeletal muscle. Striations. All right, so smooth muscle does have actin and myosin that slide over each other, but it's not arranged in a sarcomere. It doesn't have that same repeating pattern over and over again. And I'll have to remember next time to bring in a model of how skeletal muscle works. The actin is attached to the cell membrane, and the whole cell kind of gets shrunken down. It doesn't shrink just from end to end, but the whole cell just kind of shrinks down as a result of that. All right, but nonetheless, calcium is necessary for skeletal muscle to contract, for cardiac muscle to contract, and smooth muscle to contract that controls the association of actin and myosin so that it slides over each other. So your heart couldn't contract without proper levels of calcium. Okay, so those are the three kinds of muscle and some background information on how muscle contracts. So if you were going to pick an ion, right, what ion is necessary for muscle contraction? Calcium ion. All right, and calcium ion, we say it's an ion. Do I have it on the slide anywhere? Calcium, we say, is an ion right here. Here's calcium. The chemical signal symbol for calcium is capital C, little a. But what else do you see with capital C, little a? 2+. That means that this little thing right here, calcium, has an electrical charge. Okay, what kind of electrical charge do we have on calcium? It's positive as opposed to a negative charge. And how many are there? There are two. All right, and because it has these two positive electrical charges on it, we call that an ion. So anything that has a charge on it is an ion. And in hospitals, we usually call these things electrolytes. Electrolytes, because they have an electrical charge. And it affects the excitability of tissues all over your body. Okay, maybe I'll spell it on, I don't think I have it on, I might have it in here. How do you spell electrolyte? E? I need a nice dark, nice, here. E? Electro, and light is L-Y-T-E. Right, which means that it could be a calcium or maybe a sodium ion or a potassium ion. So a lot of times people have an imbalance in their electrolytes, which means then that they have trouble with their heart contracting or with their nerves functioning. So a lot of times we need to measure what the level of their electrolytes are very fast, including the levels of calcium. right here that I have on the slide. So you might be in an emergency room someplace, so an OR, and somebody's going to say, we need some lights on this patient, stat. What does stat mean? Right away, immediately, because it could be life-threatening. So what are you going to do when you hear that command, we need some lights on this patient? Are you going to go look for some more lights to shine on that, or flashlights, so that who's ever working on this patient, they can see what they're doing? What do they mean? They don't mean lights, they mean electrolytes. So you're going to have to draw some blood and run it down to the lab and get those concentrations measured right away, because it affects what? Contraction, nerve conduction, and all kinds of other important things for that particular patient. All right, so this is an electrolyte. So we are very electrical beings because we have all these ions inside of our body doing all these different tasks for us. All right, which is going to be a major part of physiology when you get to physiology. All right, I think that's all I need to say about this introductory chapter for muscle. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. And make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And then I'll see you guys upstairs that have lab today yet. Yeah.
Yes.